From WYPR, I'm Rob Sivak, sitting in for Tom Hall, and this is Maryland Morning. We start today with a conversation with a local Syrian imam about how the Muslim community is reacting to the heated public debate over recent terror attacks and the surge of refugees fleeing Syria's civil war. Then we'll talk about the legal and political challenges those Syrian refugees face as they seek safe havens in Europe and the United States, with Ruben Chandrasekhar of the International Rescue Committee and David Rocha of the ACLU. Next, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of Middletown. And just in time for Thanksgiving, our regular foodie and restaurant owner Sasha Waldhandler joins us to share her scrumptious squash recipes, from butternut squash soup to squash lasagna. But first, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak, sitting in for Tom Hall. This morning, we want to talk about some of the reactions we've been hearing over the past week by many politicians in this country to recent terror attacks by ISIS, the self-styled Islamic State group responsible for the November 13th Paris killings, among other atrocities. And reactions also to the resettlement of Syrian refugees who are fleeing ISIS and the ongoing carnage of the Syrian civil war. The two subjects have become intertwined and, some say, confused in the public debate. Imam Mohammed Bashar Arafat joins us this morning to discuss how the Muslim community here in Baltimore is reacting to the growing chorus of anti-Syrian refugee and anti-Muslim rhetoric by U.S. governors, members of Congress, and presidential candidates. Imam Arafat is a native of Syria, serving in the 1980s as an imam in Damascus, but he's been living in the U.S. for 26 years. He was imam of the Islamic Society in Baltimore from 1989 to 1993. He's also president and founder of the Civilizations Exchange and Cooperation Foundation and currently serves as president of the Islamic Affairs Council of Maryland. He's taught at several universities in the Baltimore area, including Johns Hopkins, Goucher, and the College of Notre Dame, and runs exchange programs for university students. Imam Mohammed Bashar Arafat, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Has it been difficult recently to be a Muslim and a Syrian in the United States?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, for me, I have been really enjoying my life here in this country for the past 26 years. I have come to realize that really the people just, they don't know. But once they know, they have nothing but respect and kindness, and that's what I have seen even for the past 2 weeks. I mean, I have received so many calls from other interfaith colleagues, whether they are rabbis or priests, saying that what's this? I mean, this is alien to the American culture. We have been there and we have done that after 9/11. We went through this Islamophobia and we have been forward now. We are moving forward, and this rhetoric, Imam, this is just, we feel that bringing us backward.
Indeed.
And this is where I really feel that what we are hearing, I mean, I understand that this is election time and the people are using those issues to really, you know, just score some points. But I don't think this is healthy. This is not healthy for America, especially when you go overseas.
Yeah.
And even here in the United States, I mean, for me as a Syrian who came 26 years, and I, imam, teaching, doing interfaith programs, and most recently also conducting speakers programs through the State Department in more than 30 countries. And just last month, I came back from Uganda and Ghana, doing programs with the U.S. embassies there. we are trying to build bridges, you know, with those communities and those countries. And this kind of rhetoric really is not healthy at all, because I do get those responses from the people overseas. So, but for us here in this country, I mean, take these Syrian refugees. Even though I was just last Thursday listening to the Congress and the session last Thursday, and I was myself amazed to hear that since the whole issues of allowing Syrian refugees to come to the United States, almost 23,000 who applied and 7,000 were interviewed, and only 2,200 who were allowed to come. We have, I mean, such a process to allow immigrants to come here that it's one of the hardest in the world. And I just, you know, I feel really sad to hear this about also the Syrian refugees, who we have never heard one of those people who came have committed any act of terror or anything to disturb the peace here in this country.
Yeah. Yet, nevertheless, we have this kind of rhetoric in the ether, in the media. I want to play a brief sample just to remind our listeners of just what kind of rhetoric is being used by several leading Republican presidential candidates last week, including two members of the U.S. Senate, and get your comments.
And surveillance is okay. If you don't mind, I want to surveil. I want surveillance of these people that are coming in. I want surveillance of certain mosques, okay? If that's okay. I want surveillance. And you know what? We've had it before and we'll have it again.
Those planes that flew into the Twin Towers weren't piloted by a bunch of ticked off Presbyterians.
If there's a rabid dog running around your neighborhood, you probably not going to assume something good about that dog, and you're probably going to put your children out of the way. Doesn't mean that you hate all dogs.
Imam Arafat, as someone who's devoted so much of your life and career to promoting a better understanding of Islam, doesn't that sound like Islamophobia to you?
It does, and I'm so sad as an American to hear this kind of rhetoric that, for me as a Muslim, I cannot say it toward somebody who is a Christian or somebody who is Jewish. We have to separate between those who intend to do harms, whether they are, you know, Americans or non-Americans, whether they are Muslims or Christians or Jews. Because when I see somebody buying gun and he's on the terrorist watch list and still being able to buy a gun and go and shoot and kill innocent people just because his name is not Ahmed or Muhammad or he's not Muslim, nobody says anything about, you know, his religion. This is something really not only the Muslim have to say, excuse me, this is wrong. Also, the peace-loving Americans, the Christians and the Jews and the Hindu and others, we all have to stand up that this will, we know, push us backward rather than making us move forward.
On 88.1 WYPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivak, speaking with Imam Mohammed Bashar Arafat. Why do you think so many Americans perceive Islam so negatively?
To be honest with you, the Muslim community in the United States have to do better in terms of outreach. They are doing, but I think we should do more. As far as mosques, we have to do more interfaith activities. We have to do more programs, conferences, seminars, in order to create an atmosphere where people can ask questions. I mean, unfortunately, the media does not give moderate voices enough time. I get these questions all the time. Where are, you know, the moderate voices? Where are the scholars who say something against ISIS and against the terrorists? Well, excuse me, they are saying a lot, and there are so many statements, and there are so many fatwas. But the media is really interested in those who are, you know, creating conflicts. They are interested in ISIS. And who are those people who hijacked, you know, pieces of land from Syria and Iraq, and they created their own state in the midst of all of this chaos we have been seeing, not only in Syria, but also since the invasion of Iraq. We have to go backward also and say, what happened after we invaded Iraq? What are the mistakes have been done? We have to also blame ourselves into some of the things and the mistakes that happened over there that created all of this chaos over there. For me, as a Syrian, I hear from my mother, who is still in Damascus, and my family, who are still in Damascus, that, you know, all of those people, they are not Syrians. I mean, it's interesting to say here that ISIS, who is now in occupying those regions, they are not Syrians themselves. So I just want the people to pause for a second and just go and let's review what was our foreign policy toward the whole region in the past 10 years. In the past 10 years. And then who are those Boko Haram? Who are those Al-Shabaab? Who are those, all of these terrorist groups? Do they really represent Islam?
And they do not, in your opinion.
Of course not, because the teachings of the Quran is completely different than what they are doing. I mean, they are doing harm to the Muslims more than the non-Muslims. Syrians, they have been, you know, running away from them now for years. I mean, you are seeing and hearing what they are doing to the Muslims before the non-Muslims, let alone doing things that is totally against the teachings of the Quran when they go and they kill, especially Christians and the Yazidis and others who have been living in peace for centuries in Syria.
Is your family safe in Damascus?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, they are living in Damascus right now as safe as they can be, but really, you know, you cannot predict, because there has been indiscriminate shelling, you know, in the past. But, you know, my mother and my father came here just a couple of months ago, but they don't want to stay. I tried to apply for them. They said, no, thank you. We don't want to leave Damascus. They came back. They like just to come and visit, and then they go back. But it's really sad to see the whole atmosphere right now here in the United States, where we have to go and reach out to one another and to strengthen our security by knowing one another. The Muslim community in the United States is in a much, much better shape than what's happening in Europe and the Muslim community in Europe.
Thank you. Imam Mohammed Bashar Arafat, president and co-founder of the Civilizations Exchange and Cooperation Foundation and currently president of the Islamic Affairs Council of Maryland. We've got more information about Imam Arafat and his foundation on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivak. Ahead on Maryland Morning, we continue our focus on the public debate over Syrian refugees and what rights do they have anyway. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Rob Sivak, sitting in for Tom Hall. More than 4 million refugees have fled the bloody civil war in Syria over the past 5 years. That's about 10% of all the world's refugees and displaced people, a fifth of Syria's population. And many of them are still waiting after arduous escapes and dangerous journeys to find safe haven in Europe and the United States. But in the wake of the ISIS attacks in Paris, November 13th, and growing fears of further terrorism, the welcome mat for Syrian refugees is being pulled away in some places. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the situation facing those Syrian refugees, the resettlement process, and the balance between national security concerns and civil liberties is David Rocha, Senior Staff Attorney, the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. And on the phone with us is Ruben Chandrasekhar, Executive Director of the Baltimore Branch of the International Rescue Committee, one of nine nonprofit agencies that manages refugee resettlements in the United States. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me on.
Gentlemen, last week, 30 state governors asked the federal government to put a hold on any further resettlement of Syrian refugees until security concerns have been more thoroughly addressed. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan issued a statement that was actually more moderate than some of his fellow Republican governors. His statement read in part, "Following the terrorist attacks on Paris just 4 days ago, and after careful consideration, I'm now requesting that federal authorities cease any additional settlements of refugees from Syria in Maryland until the U.S. government can provide appropriate assurances that refugees from Syria pose no threat to public safety." David Rocha, do these governors have any legal standing to refuse refugee resettlements or to demand extraordinary security vetting?
No. I mean, in a word, immigration is a federal matter, and it's the federal government that controls who can and cannot be admitted to the country. And once those decisions have been made, our Constitution and our laws protect everyone who is here from discrimination on the basis of national origin or religion, and governors have no legal authority to bar Syrian refugees or refugees from any other country, nor Muslim refugees, nor refugees from any other faith tradition or no faith tradition at all.
Well, at least one local politician who thinks Governor Hogan is on solid ground is Republican Congressman Andy Harris of Maryland. Here's what he told a reporter with a local CBS affiliate, WJZ-TV.
"Look, I think given our proximity to Washington, D.C., which is an obvious terrorist target, I think it's the right thing to do. We don't have the ability to figure out who's here to do us harm and who isn't. If this administration doesn't set up that capability, then we should never take immigrants from areas of the world where people have vowed to do us harm. And this is one of those areas of the world."
Democrats have been more supportive of the Syrian refugees. Former Maryland governor and presidential candidate Martin O'Malley is calling for the U.S. to admit nearly 70,000 Syrian refugees this year. That's well more than President Obama's target of 10,000. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have been supportive of the call for additional refugees to be brought in. But even as the Republican governors were asking the Obama administration to put the brakes on resettlement, the House of Representatives on Thursday passed with a largely bipartisan vote the so-called Refugee Resettlement Oversight and Security Act of 2015. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan urging support for the bill on the House floor.
"It calls for a new standard of verification for refugees from Syria and Iraq. It would mean a pause in the program until we can be certain beyond any doubt that those coming here are not a threat. It's that simple. And I don't think it's asking too much."
David, what's the real aim of this legislation, which President Obama, by the way, has said he would veto?
Well, the aim is clearly to bar refugees from Syria. You know, it has to be said that the hysteria that is being whipped up now is sickening, morally repugnant, and wrong. We don't hear calls to bar people from coming from France or Belgium. But the facts, at least as they are known, are that all of the people who participated in the attacks, the horrific attacks in Paris, were from France or Belgium. And the fact that we don't hear calls to bar people from France or Belgium tells you, I think, what's really going on behind this. That it is, and it also is important to say that the refugees that we are talking about admitting to the United States, the process has no connection to the wave of refugees coming to Europe. The process to come to the United States as a refugee from Syria is about a two-year process, and those refugees are probably the most scrutinized group of people of any who enter the United States. And the idea that we have some kind of crisis here, or the idea that the people who are being admitted after this generally about a two-year process are a threat to safety in this country, it is pure, unadulterated nonsense. And the people saying it know better, should know better, and are engaged in the most rank kind of religious demagoguery that is so morally repugnant and so dangerous, and it's shocking and disgusting that it is happening in this country today. And I just feel like that has to be said.
Still, many Americans seem to be worried about the refugees posing a potential terrorist threat, and they want to be sure extra steps are taken to screen these Syrian refugees. And let me turn to Ruben Chandrasekhar. You deal with these resettlements all the time. Would you say that the refugee screening process is as robust as David suggests?
Absolutely. You know, every single person who applies to enter the U.S. As a refugee undergoes rigorous screenings by different elements of the U.S. government. These security screenings involve multiple in-person interviews with every single applicant, and the collection of biometric data like fingerprints, and in the case of Syrian applicants, iris scans. And this biometric data is filtered through the Department of Homeland Security databases, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and multiple intelligence agencies. And all refugee applicants, regardless of where they come from, be it from Europe, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, must clear these security checks before they're moved forward in the process. And as David said, when all is said and done, a typical refugee applicant may have to wait anywhere from 12 to 36 months before they clear the various security checks and are welcome to the U.S. In addition, I'd just like to add that attempts by federal and state officials to limit the arrival of Syrian refugees in particular is really grounded in misinformation about who Syrian refugees are. If you look at the events of Friday, November 13th, that happened in Paris, the world caught a glimpse of what a terrorist group like ISIS is capable of. And I think what some people have forgotten is that the over 4 million Syrian refugees who have fled their country, in addition to the 8 million people who are displaced internally in that country, have been subjected to not just ISIS-type terror, but the terror of the Assad government and various other armed military forces in that country. The Syrian refugee crisis is characterized by the brutal and indiscriminate killing of civilians and has caused the greatest mass migration of people since World War II. People wouldn't be fleeing the country if they weren't fleeing terror. And all of them, before coming to the U.S., are screened rigorously.
Mm-hmm. On 88.1 WYPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak speaking with Ruben Chandrasekhar, executive director of the International Rescue Committee, and David Rocha, senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Maryland. David, a refugee applying for admission to the United States or any other country clearly doesn't have the rights of a citizen yet, but what rights, what fundamental rights do refugees have when they've left their home country?
Well, most of the rights that refugees have are grounded actually in international humanitarian law, which has been codified in U.S. law in terms of our asylum process. That is, but most of that law applies for people who land on American soil. The refugee process that we're talking about now, where refugees are screened overseas, is, again, governed largely by American statutory law, by the federal rules governing that admission process. The Constitution sets some minimal constraints on the rules that the government can set up. Our immigration laws have frequently discriminated on the basis of nationality. So if the federal government passed a law that was discriminating on the basis of country of origin, that probably would not violate the Constitution. I don't think certainly in anything approaching modern times, our government has ever discriminated in the immigration process on the basis of religion. And I think to do so would be a sickening and disheartening prospect. And I think it would almost certainly be unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Ruben Chandrasekhar, do you believe the national security concerns that have been raised about refugees are going to play havoc with the resettlement process in America, perhaps drag it out longer than its current 2 years?
I believe so, you know, especially with the passage of H.R. 4038 by the U.S. House of Representatives. You know, this bill would make it, you know, very difficult for legitimate Syrian and Iraqi refugees to get to the U.S. And it really introduces a bunch of unnecessary and, quite frankly, impractical requirements that would really hamper our efforts to resettle some of the most vulnerable and persecuted people, many of whom are victims of terrorism. You know, it must be stated that since the U.S. Began resettling refugees in 1975, we have resettled a little over 3 million refugees in this country, including, I might add, over 100,000 Iraqis over the last decade. You know, we have a very rigorous screening mechanisms in place to ensure that, you know, refugee applicants who enter this country are those who are fleeing persecution and not those persecuting others.
I'm afraid we're out of time, Ruben. Yeah. We're going to have to cut it there. Ruben Chandrasekhar, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee, and David Rocha, Senior Staff Attorney, ACLU of Maryland. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivak. There's more to come. Stay with us on 88.1.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us on Monday mornings here on Maryland Morning. This week, she brings us her review of Middletown. It's at the Theatrical Mining Company in Baltimore.
Loneliness, luck, or the lack of it, birth, and death weave their way through Will Eno's play, Middletown. In the opening scene, the character of a policeman describes the town. Population, stable. Elevation, same. The main street is called Main Street. People come, people go. Crying, by the way, in both directions. Stylistically, this description is reminiscent of the stage manager's description of Grover's Corners at the start of Our Town. Much of what follows is an homage to that classic American play. This past June, I moderated a playwrights panel at the second International Thornton Wilder Conference. Will Eno was one of the panelists. He praised Wilder's immense skill at writing about the quotidian, the commonplace, the everyday. The quotidian and the struggle of everyday life is the core of Middletown. Under Barry Feinstein's direction, the performances in the Theatrical Mining Company's production emphasize the ordinariness of the characters, along with their desperation. Consider the character of a policeman identified as Cop and skillfully played by Mike Page. Although we later see the cop's compassionate side, in his first scene, he's menacing. He welcomes us to Middletown at the same time that, for no apparent reason, he bullies and attacks the town drunk, played by Jonathan Saxman.
Now, what are you doing here?
I don't know. I was just walking around. Later tonight, I thought I
forget about before and after. I mean now.
Well, I don't know because I'm...
You don't know because you don't know. That's the trouble. The beauty. The trouble. So let's just leave it at that. I think you dropped something. The problem with people... Don't interrupt!
Middletown's everyday folk, the cop, the librarian, a young wife, a handyman, all have dark sides. The play might have been just a series of vignettes, but an affecting plot develops between the handyman and the young wife, who's eager to start a family, although her husband is mostly out of town. Movingly portrayed by Lisa Bryan and Michael Zemerell,
The wife, Mary, and the handyman, John, are the beating heart of Middletown. The characters are eager to connect and alike in many respects, but John's worldview is much bleaker than Mary realizes.
Night is hard, you know. It gets so quiet, I never know what I'm supposed to be listening to. But it does give me time to catch up on my needless worry.
I do that. What you just did.
What?
Use humor to try to distance yourself from the pain.
I was using humor to try to be funny.
Yeah, that's something different. Like, if you ever need any help, I'm pretty good with the needless worry.
Two empty window frames are major elements in designer Bush Greenback's sparse set at Hamden's Church and Company. One window frequently frames Mary, the other frames John. The images relate to the cop's comments about the loneliness he feels looking in windows at night. These are among the many comments that repeatedly spell out Middletown's large themes. There's too much of this in Will Eno's script. For instance, when an expectant mother asks a doctor how to handle what's ahead, he tells her, "Part of the whole great march of humanity is just swinging your arms and walking, just smiling and moving forward." Director Feinstein's generally gentle approach helps counteract some of the didacticism. If the pacing picks up during the run, that'll help too. The simplicity of tone that the playwright is going for is more difficult to achieve than it would seem, particularly when paired with themes of overarching depth. Feinstein has eliminated a fairly lengthy intermission scene, perhaps to cut down on cast size. There are 11 actors even without it. In the missing scene, a new set of actors portrays audience members discussing the play we're watching. Even here, the characters launch into a commentary on birth, death, and what happens in between. So, a little less theorizing about the big questions may not be a bad thing. But most important, this theatrical mining company production gets the human side right. And in the end, when we witness the parallel but opposite fates of Mary and John, the writing, direction, and performances come together in a place that is truly touching.
The Theatrical Mining Company's production of Middletown is at Church & Company on Falls Road in Hamden until December 6th. Next week, theater critic J. Wynn Russick returns with her review of X's and O's at Baltimore's Center Stage. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break, our resident foodie Sasha Wohlhandler on what to put next to the turkey. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's time now for What You Got Cooking.
Cooking, how's about cooking something up with me?
Thanksgiving is right around the corner, so today we want to touch base with our resident foodie, Sasha Wohlhandler, for some tips on what to include on our holiday menu. Sasha and her husband, Steve Susser, run Sasha's 527 restaurant and catering on Charles Street in Baltimore. Happy Thanksgiving, Sasha.
Happy Thanksgiving, Tom.
So we sort of do this every year. You come on a few days before Thanksgiving, we talk about, you know, what can garnish the table along with the turkey. And today we're going to talk squash in all of its wonderful varieties.
Well, it just seems like for Thanksgiving you have to have some squash, and you know, it's such a great vegetable. There's so many ways to flavor it. It's kind of a loose vegetable that gives itself up to many different flavor profiles. For example, the norm would be the maple syrup, the brown sugar, the regular sugar, the honey balsamic. All of this comes to dance really robustly with squash, but alternatively, you can also bring some other spices to the dance. That would be coriander and curry and brown sugar and ginger. They skip right to a waltz. And taking that dance format a little further, sage and basil are no wallflowers either. So even the novice cook, I just want you to listen to some of these ideas because of the fact that I don't want you to go get something prepared. You too, novice cook, can flex your culinary muscles and make something with some great recipes that we have here.
Absolutely. So let's talk first about butternut squash. You've got butternut, you've got acorn, you've got a couple different kinds of squashes. But butternut squash, there's a lot of things you can do with this, from entrees to soup.
Right? It's that gorgeous, sexy sort of figure eight in beige, and you've seen that kind of thing. You don't know what to do with it. It's really beautiful. It has a pale beige skin. And the hardest part about butternut squash is cutting it. Be very careful when you cut it. And then peel that skin off like it's a great big potato. And underneath you have that orange gorgeous flesh. The dirty little secret here, folks, if you're thinking I'm not going to go to all that work, you can get already chunks of butternut squash in most of the supermarkets around
this
time.
Right. They do sell it all pre-cut. But, you know, it's not all that bad. It's like peeling a carrot.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Not so bad. Yeah.
So you got your chunks. First, we're going to talk about roasting it. Roast those chunks in the oven at about 425. Toss them with some olive oil, salt, and pepper. And it's about 30 minutes to 40 minutes, and you will have some soft chunks. What you can do 15 minutes into it is you can choose one of those flavor profiles I talk about. If you want to get it more into the honey and the maple syrup and the brown sugar, paint that on with your olive oil and then toss it a few times. At 30 to 35 minutes, you're going to have them really soft and malleable. Now, what you want to do then, let's talk about a great salad. Can you imagine shredded up purple cabbage with these chunks of gorgeous orange butternut squash? Toss in some toasted pecans, toss in some honey balsamic vinegar, toss a little bit of goat cheese on top.
What, yeah, delicious.
Is that not a gorgeous salad?
Yeah. And it looks pretty, too, because the color, as you say, the orange of the flesh
the
of the butternut
and
squash
the
is gorgeous. Yeah. When I roast squash, I roast it for a little less than that, and they're kind of hard almost, or they're
little al dente.
Firm, and they like take the place of potatoes.
They're delicious.
I mean, they're substantive.
So
yeah.
I wanted
really good.
I'm going from your soft to making them really soft because we're going to make a squash puree because I think, guys, and you could make a wonderful soup, a squash soup to bring. You're going to take those squash that you've just roasted in the oven, you've made them nice and soft, and you're going to take some chicken stock. You can buy prepared chicken stock in any of your grocery stores. You're going to saute up some chopped onions, and I'll put the exact amount on the website, with some ginger, some curry, some coriander, some brown sugar, salt and pepper, and you're going to saute that up, let all the vegetables get nice and soft. Then you're going to put in your chicken stock and simmer that for about 10-15 minutes. It is wonderful. You will get all those aromatics of the curry and the ginger. Then you're going to bring it over to the blender. Do only a half amount in the blender because when you do hot items in the blender, it can explode. So just put half the chicken stock in with all that soft squash, and you are going to puree it. And it is going to be the most divine curry ginger soup. Put a little dollop of lime sour cream on top if you want to add bacon bits. And guys, you are going to be a rock star.
Absolutely. And it's a nice substantial soup, you know, and it's just great. Terrific. Butternut squash soup. Of course, when you've pureed it, you brought something here. It's a squash lasagna. This looks terrific.
Well, moving that same puree with those same squash that we just put in the oven and we've got them nice and soft, we're going to mash them like you'd mash a potato. Put some salt and pepper in. We're also going to add some of the Parmesan cheese, and we're also going to add some ricotta cheese to it. We're going to make a squash lasagna. If you've got vegetarians there, folks, you could make this a few days earlier. It is so easy. Cook up your lasagna, your sheets of lasagna. You're going to make a bechamel sauce. Now, don't freak out. Just drink a little more of
that
wine.
Yeah, that sounds fancy, sorry.
I know. Just drink a little more of that wine I told you earlier. You're going to take a little couple of cups of milk. I put sage into the milk because the milk, as it simmers, it gets all that sage flavor. If you don't want the sage, you can use basil. And then you're going to make a roux. Don't get crazy on me. Just drink another sip of glass of wine. We're going to take a couple of tablespoons of flour, like three or four, and three or four of butter. You're melting
it
together, and you're
thicking
it up. And when it's a kind of a pasty thing, you add that to the simmering milk, and voila, in a minute, you're going to have a sauce. You're going to add salt and pepper to that, a little nutmeg, and that sauce is going to be your sauce to make your lasagna. Then you put the sheets down of the noodles, the puree of the butternut squash, some of this fantastic sage bechamel sauce, then some mozzarella, layer it on up, Tom, is that not this is delicious?
This is absolutely delicious. And it kind of, in a way, it kind of almost looks like mashed potatoes or something. And we've got a picture of it on the website, but it's just delicious.
It's
all
delicious.
Those different flavors and the spices
and
are
the,
just great.
And the orange squash comes through, and it really is a wonderful thing. Your vegetarians will kiss you, and your carnivores will kiss you,
you
as well. Let's move on to that acorn squash.
You have acorn squash. You've got two or three of them here, and you've stuffed them with different things. I love this one here. You've got some shrimp, and you've got some spaghetti squash stuffing the acorn squash.
Well, why
not?
I mean, the acorn squash, the same thing. Cut it in half, shove it in the oven, salt and pepper. Start watching it at about 30 minutes to see how soft it is. You are going to either certainly season it with oil, salt, and pepper, and then either put maple syrup on, put some of your brown sugar or the other spices. I stuffed it. Why not stuff that acorn? First of all, it can serve by itself before I go into that. It looks beautiful. Figure one acorn squash cut into quarters can easily serve 4 to 6 people. You cut it in half first, roast it, and then you cut it into quarters. It's very easy.
Mm-hmm.
Or use it as a little soldier to carry things. And why not take all that extra stuffing after you've stuffed that bird? Take the rest of it, rather than put it into a Pyrex dish, stuff it into an acorn squash.
Yeah,
how
it looks
beautiful
gorgeous.
Is that?
Yeah, because it's roasted on the outside, so it's got all these beautiful fall
and the
colors.
Other,
it's great.
The other one is, if you're vegetarians, you want to continue the vegetarian motif, make a spaghetti squash, take a cut it in half again, roast it, and then take a fork. Kids love to see this transformation of a squash turning into big, long, gorgeous ringlets of spaghetti. It's so exciting. So it's the holiday season. For those of you who are beginning to flex those culinary muscles, squash the desire to buy something prepared. You can do it. You can cook it. You can create it. You can eat it. Love it. And finish that glass of wine. Happy Thanksgiving, Tom.
Happy Thanksgiving, Sasha. Sasha Wolhandler and her husband, Steve Sisser, own Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street here in Baltimore. Come to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, for more information and some pictures of the dishes that we talked about today. That'll do it for us this morning. Coming up Wednesday, we'll have some great music for you here on Maryland Morning. A terrific bluegrass and roots music group called Charm City Junction will be here playing some tunes in studio, and I'll talk to Judy Collins about her new album of duets. Looking forward to having you join us Wednesday morning here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.